Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
We are thrilled today to be joined by Anna Sonoda, who is an author and a child psychologist, and she wrote a book called Duck, Duck, Groom that caught our attention at CrimeCon, and we felt like we needed to have her on to discuss the topic in general. So, Anna, thanks for joining us today.
No problem, guys. It's such a pleasure to be here with you both, Jamie and John. And as a licensed clinical social worker who's trying to make an effort to improve the way that people understand grooming, this is an incredible step in the right direction for the movement that I'm trying to create and build across the country. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah, and we'll get more into that movement in our state here in Kentucky in just a moment. But first, I want to start with the basics about the book. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's about and then also what inspired you to write this book?
Absolutely. So Duck, Duck, Groom, Understanding How a Child Becomes a Target, was born out of my frustration with a repeated conversation I kept having with parents on the playground, in coffee shops, or at birthday parties, because my background as a clinical social worker is a former therapist to convicted sex offenders. And so when I left that position and started raising my own family, I recognized that something had been left within the clinical space, and it hadn't made its way to the forefront of everyday parents. So I came into parenting recognizing risks of something called grooming, that is the perversive courtship process that happens in advance and alongside physical child sexual abuse. And what I realized is parent after parent that I would interact with would say, oh, I'm worried about that guy over there, or I'm worried about the guy in the van. I'm not necessarily thinking about a family member, an older relative who maybe lives in the house, an older sibling who might be in the home. And what I recognized was there's a gap. There's a gap in the understanding within people who are on the front lines of protecting our families and communities. And I also recognized when I did some digging and read what was on the market, it seemed like there was a lot of fear. I don't know about you guys. I know you have your own families, but gosh, parents today are inundated with tremendous amounts of fearful messages when it comes to raising their kids. And I wanted to change from a fear-based approach to one that is proactive and prepares parents to recognize the grooming process, not because they're going to be stuck in paralysis, but because they're going to be prepared to respond if anything should happen.
Yeah, when John and I were kids, at least, there was a commercial on TV at 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? We were talking about stranger danger. And in a lot of ways, reflectively, it seems like that drove people, made it easier for individuals that were close to families to do grooming. It's an intentional process. Can you talk a little bit about the four steps of grooming that you outline in your book and how to recognize them, why that's so important?
Yeah, I think that's an incredible piece of this movement. When you really look at the foundation of what I'm attempting to do, if I were to say somebody's on fire to you guys right now, what would be the steps that you would tell them to do to put that fire out?
Stop, drop, and roll.
Exactly. So we need a stop, drop, and roll approach to grooming, because this is happening in every community, in every socioeconomic group, in every education level across the country and beyond. So what I developed through writing and doing my own research was the four general stages of grooming. I call it the grooming formula, or shorthand, the four F's. And those are flattery, favoritism, forbidden fruits, and fear. And at each stage, a potential target is being identified, selected, because not every child is selected to be groomed. Depends on what sort of environment they're coming from, what kind of vulnerabilities they might possess, in their physical environment or internally that a predator may recognize. But at each of these four stages, a predator is using a child's developmental stage against them for their own benefit. So what do I mean by that? I mean, take, for example, favoritism. If I'm in a classroom setting and I want to target one of the children and I say, oh, you're my favorite student. You're my favorite athlete on this team. I've never taught a student as fill in the blank as you. For that child, being selected feels really good. It feels really positive. Right. But what happens to their connections with their outside peers? Do you guys remember what you would do to the teacher's pet?
Oh, yeah. You criticize and exclude them.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that isolates a child from their peer group. Now, when we look at stage three, the forbidden fruit stage, what do I mean by that? I mean offering the child ways to break the mores or policies of parents, communities, school, for example, just the norms, the normal rules. A predator is really keen at saying, oh, they don't understand how mature you are. I'll let you do this. If you spend time with me, I'll make this available to you. And that in and of itself tests a child during a phase, typically when a child is already sort of testing norms and saying, gosh, I don't know if I agree with everything my parents are teaching me or my religious community is teaching me or my community is teaching me. So this sets a child up to feel isolation from caregivers or the key people in their life who would otherwise be the ones that would come to their rescue and help in a situation like this. So that's why I think it's really important that we give shortcuts for today's parents. Just like stop, drop, and roll is quick and easy to remember, I want parents and listeners to recognize the 4F formula so that they can detect and intervene, because that's the best news of this movement. It's saying, if you recognize that grooming has started, you can and should interrupt it.
Absolutely. In your book, you mentioned that a very high percentage, in fact, I don't want to misquote you, but over 90% of child sexual abuse victims know their abuser. How can parents balance, you know, wanting to develop a sense of trust within a community to their child, but also being very vigilant?
I love this question. I deal with this on a daily basis. As a mom of five myself, I am constantly assessing risk, right? So one of the things that I like to teach people is you have standards of behavior in your family or in your household because it's who you are. It is not about who other people are. It's about who you are. So having a conversation as a family, who do we allow in our home? Who do we allow in bedrooms? Who's allowed to be part of bathing routines or bathroom rituals? What spaces are off limits to people in the neighborhood or friends or family? Bringing it a little bit more into consciousness, instead of saying we can never do this or we can never do that. Instead, I want parents to be a little bit more mindful about the potential fodder for predation. And one of the components of the book that I talk about is that predators run on gas, grooming, access, and space. And in my research and in my work with convicted offenders, I was repeatedly seeing that predators need three ingredients for successful child sexual abuse: grooming, access, and space. And depending on what your role is in a community, in a family, in a school, or in an activity, you may have a different level of access and space alone with a child or children. So these are things that I want parents to conceptualize, to think about, and then to bridge that with a conversation with their children. Many children are old enough to have these dialogues with us. So it's not as if we are oppressing them with some sort of policy. We're saying, hey, these are some of the things that I want you to be aware of and notice. If you get special treatment, if somebody gives you money or gifts or food, if somebody identifies you as being exceptional or special, that's something to let me know, because potential mentors are wonderful. But any good adult, any good caring older child or adult mentor is going to want to support and uphold your policies as a family. And anyone who undermines those policies, that needs a second glance.
I was kind of flipping through some stuff last night on social media, and I was made aware that there's a legislature in Kentucky who wants to make it part of state law to almost lay out potential signs of grooming. And I'm sure that within the law that will be prepared, there will be some ways to make that publicly available and some ways to educate parents written within that law, I would assume. So you mentioned your movement and what you hope to do. And I don't know if this particular legislature was, you know, a reader of your book or what, but I think it's awesome that even at the state law level, there's some resources beginning to become available and more awareness is being brought to it. So that's just really incredible.
I completely agree with you. I've actually noticed a building momentum of states that are taking on grooming as a subject to make it a misdemeanor. They can't make it a felony, but they can make it a misdemeanor. And boy, oh boy, one of the things that predators taught me when I was in the room with them one-on-one was the one thing they're trying to avoid and evade is attention, negative attention. So a policy like this in Kentucky, that legislator is going out of their way to protect Kentucky children in an incredible way. And we can only hope that other states follow that lead and implement misdemeanor consequences for grooming behaviors, because it is observable. That is the best news of this movement in general, is it's not random. I think when we were growing up, we had the sense, at least I did, we had the sense that it was really random, that you didn't really know who could hurt you and where it was coming from. But you're absolutely right. It was never going to come from people that we trusted and that we knew. What research shows us, though, is the exact opposite is true. We are most likely to be hurt. Our families, our children are most likely to be hurt from people that we know and trust. So as adults, we need to tune up our mindfulness and our awareness of who's attempting to gain access to our children and be in spaces where there's less supervision or no supervision.
I want to go down a rabbit hole for just a moment. Are there states currently right now that have on their books the charges for misdemeanors for grooming?
Yes. Like, I can send you a list after we're done if you'd like to post it for your listeners.
Yeah, I think that's incredible. I guess my question is, at what point there are people, I can think of students in my life that I give encouragement to. And so, like, at what point does, how can you legally define grooming, and what point has to be crossed before a charge is made? Does that make sense? Like, if I tell a kid that I'm working with or coaching, like, hey, you did a great job on that play, or I'm really proud of you, that should not be penalized legally. So at what point, you know, does that make sense what I'm asking?
I think that same thing as a parent. Like, what if I hope my kids are liked by their teachers. How do I know when it stops being healthy? Yes. How can I figure that out?
Yes. This is a great conversation. I'm so glad we're having it, because you know that every one of your listeners is thinking the exact same thing. And what I would begin the conversation by saying is, we are all focused on protecting kids. But an element of this conversation, the other side of the coin, is that we have to protect adult reputations. I need to know that when my spouse goes on an overnight trip with the school as a chaperone, that the policies in place protect his reputation. I need to know that the activities my children spend time in have enough respect for the volunteers and the adults who spend their precious time with kids, that it respects their reputation. So how do we do that? Well, when we're looking at things like finding that threshold, we're looking for certain things like, are they allowing the child to break the law? You know, oftentimes predators will craft and create environments. Let's take coaching or sports, for example. Many predators will create environments in which it's easy to observe children undressing or showering or getting dressed. So that might be something that, as a policy, for a soccer league or a football league, we say coaches are not permitted into the changing rooms with the players. It would be illegal for, let's say, for example, one of this like grooming gray area would be, did the coach take a child alone into a private dressing room to get changed? As dads, I can think your alarm bells and your red flags are probably going off. As a mom, I know they certainly are. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, Jamie and I both work with organizations and together, actually. And I mean, it's a very clear policy that to protect the child and ourselves, you're never alone with a kid. You always have another adult, no matter the age of the kid or the gender of the child. It's two adults. If a child wants to talk to you in private, you have to tell him that's not going to happen, but you know, Jamie will be here with us. Is that okay? Or is there another adult that you would feel more comfortable, but I can't just talk to you one-on-one. So yeah, those are just common sense things.
That example right there, John, highlights the fact that you also can go into a different environment. We can take this conversation into the lobby. We can take this conversation into the cafeteria. You know, spaces nowadays, unlike when we were growing up, there are cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that helps support the caring adults who are doing the right thing. Because let's be honest, today I'm relying on a tremendous amount of adults who are in the schools and environments with my kids as we speak. So I need adults who are in those environments to know what grooming looks like. I need them to recognize the teacher who's isolating my child for lunch alone in their classroom. I want them to be aware of the teacher who's taking a group of 12-year-old boys off campus for lunch at their house, for example. These are things that are outside of the boundaries of acceptable caring adult behavior. And you can categorize that as grooming. It's also gets exceedingly easy when we think about things like substances, because many of the predators I worked with would give their targets alcohol, drugs, let them smoke, let them use, expose them to sexual material, pornographic material. These are things that, as you all know, embedded in the policies are clearly stated. You never, ever do those things. So when we're assessing grooming, it's not as tricky as people might think, because that forbidden fruits, that third stage when a person is saying, oh, the community doesn't allow you to do that. Mom and dad don't allow you to do that, but come over to my house and I'll let you do that. That is a glaring sign that somebody needs to intervene.
Yeah, I've seen that situation play out before in the community, and it never ends well.
So obviously you are trying to put this in a very proactive, positive, let's have positive conversations about this. How difficult was it to tackle a topic like this with that attitude, where it's not been addressed that way most of the time? It's usually driven by fear and scare tactics. So how did you approach it differently, and what was that writing process like?
Yeah, Jamie, I think the thing that kept me moving throughout the writing exercises, it took me 3 years to write this book, but it had been on my heart and mind for over a decade, because I recognized over and over and over again that the message, the way that we were distributing this message, wasn't clear. I'm a caring parent. How come I never heard this message before in a clear, practical way? And, you know, we have a lot of rubbernecking in our society right now. A lot of, you know, that term when you pass a car accident and everybody's slowing down because our instinct is, whoa, what happened over there? What's the damage that's been done? And we do the same thing in child sexual abuse. Instead of equipping parents, you know, I can't tell you how many people contact me in a given week and say, I read your book and now I feel so guilty, so sad, so upset that I didn't have this information in the process of raising my child. So my mission is to educate parents from birth to graduation about what grooming looks like, because children only have one innocent childhood, and it's our responsibility, our opportunity to help protect that. So during the writing process, when I hired my developmental editor, I told her, There were three things. First of all, it had to be a book that was timeless. I did not want this to be something that was only about the issues of the early 2020s. This had to be something that you could pick up in 10 years and it was still relevant. Second, it had to be something that was empowering. I wanted checklists. I wanted things that were clear and actionable. And third, I wanted it to be something that men would be comfortable walking through an airport carrying without feeling, because you know what I'm talking about, guys. Most of the books on this topic have a very sad child on a cover in a corner with tears or maybe a tipped over teddy bear. And I wanted this to be something that was more like a toolbox, a manual, if you will. And I think I've accomplished that. And my hope and my wish is that any parent, wherever they're listening from, can pick up the book, can listen to an interview, can listen to this interview, and get some insight to figure out how they can make their environment a bit safer against predation.
That would be incredible. I want to ask you this. I'm interested. You spend your whole life, you know, in the field, working in this kind of area for a living, but in your research and in preparing this book, did you find anything surprising? Did you learn anything or discover anything that you found surprising in any way?
Well, most of my clinical experience was with men, as you would imagine, because mm-hmm. that's what the statistics uphold, is that most offenders are men. But what I did was I knew I couldn't leave out female offenders. And one of the surprising elements that I learned in my research and in my reading was that almost 50% of the time, female offenders work alongside a male co-conspirator. And I think this is really curious and interesting, especially as we're, you know, on the back end of all of the Epstein case and the fallout from that, because we have a stereotype that women are safe, that they are not going to harm us. You know, I can't think of a month that's gone by without a female offender who's been charged, whether it's a school, whether it's a daycare center. And we have a very difficult time as a culture and as a society recognizing that females can be predators as well. So that was one thing that I wanted to make sure that I addressed in the book, because too often I meet adults, oftentimes adult men, who say to me, this happened to me when I was 13, 14, 15, 16. And I never reported it to anyone. It was never in the news. Nothing ever happened, because the perception at the time was, wow, this is an advantage. This gives you a leg up in relationships or in your intimacy in the future. And what we know now, what our culture is beginning to realize, is that there is no time when an adult should be having an intimate or sexual relationship, not even a relationship, obviously, no sexual contact should be happening with children under the age of consent. And I would argue that the age of consent is only one thin barrier that we need to consider. You're raising children, as am I. An age isn't necessarily going to reflect how mature a child is, how open they are, how well they communicate, etc. So I think that was probably the most surprising thing.
The age of consent is different in every state, and it's almost mind-boggling to me, some of the laws that are in place right now, because they do not protect children. I won't get into the specifics on my feelings on that right now, but I just wanted to ask you, I'm not a doctor. I am a social worker. I'm definitely not a clinical social worker. So this is only based on my experiences. But I feel like when a child is sexually abused, number one, out of all the different types of abuses there are, I think sexual abuse has the most long-lasting trauma long-term in a child's life. But not to diminish any sexual abuse, but I feel like when a child is sexually abused by their mother or a woman in general, it seems to have much more impact than sexual abuse by a man. Again, all of them are terrible. I'm just saying, like, it's profoundly different in my experience when it's at the hands of a mother. Just wondering if you've ever seen, if you've noticed that, or if I'm off base.
You know, we're we're all in agreement that all child sexual abuse is heinous and tragic. And I think when we evaluate the role of caring women, whether it's an aunt, a mother, a grandmother, even a teacher, you know, many kids get very close to their female teachers. One of the things that we have to recognize is that every caring adult who has the opportunity to interact with a child is building and teaching that child how to perceive the world. So one of the things I recognize when communicating with survivors is that that internal dial of safety is a little bit askew. The ability to read, oh, is this a safe person? Is this a safe situation? Can I trust my gut? You know, we hear a lot of times, and Gavin De Becker writes about this, the idea that we need to listen to our internal systems that often give us a clue about safety before we've had a chance to cognitively recognize risk. And I think when we think about how fundamental female caring roles are to the development of most individuals, that is crushing for future relationships. And many adult survivors need communities, maybe mental health support, maybe specific counseling, trauma work, in order to understand the process, how it unfolded, and to alleviate themselves from the unnecessary shame. Because when I interface with individuals, I hear all the time that one of the most powerful results of maybe it's the workbook that I wrote called Duck, Duck, Groom, A Guided Journal for Adult Survivors. They say, I had no idea that I was groomed. I just thought I chose this. I thought that it was my decision to, you know, walk through the trap. And I think it's so important as we look at any predator and target dynamic that we fully understand that the grooming process is what convinces victims that they did something wrong. And part of this movement is obviously alleviating that in the best way possible, because it's impacting people, as you said, for their relationships, maybe careers, maybe educationally, maybe mental health, maybe substance use. So it has lasting long-term impacts. And we have our work cut out for us as a community and as a society to bridge the gap when it comes to survivors, especially male survivors, finding spaces where they can find that support and receive that support in earnest.
You've used the term movement several times in this conversation and in the book. Do you feel like as a society we're moving in the right direction and this is a big part of it? And are there other resources out there moving in the same direction that you're hoping this conversation will go?
Well, I'll answer the last question first.
Okay.
I think agencies like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children are doing incredible work. For those who don't know, they are a clearinghouse for all cyber tips of child exploitation or child sexual abuse material online. So the reason that a local jurisdiction is going to receive a case is often because it's come through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So they're doing phenomenal work. They have videos and resource guides far longer than I could ever provide your readers. So that's a wonderful agency to be aware of. As question one goes, what we're noticing and what I'm seeing in the clinical field is that we are changing language. You may notice this in the work that both of you do, that instead of maybe using more blunt language, we're now sort of softening language in a way. And one of the changes that has occurred in the treatment of sexual offenders is the term MAPS. Are you all familiar with that term?
Help me remember what that stands for, because I do feel like I've heard of that.
Yeah, and it's growing momentum, and it gives me pause, and I'd be interested to hear both of your thoughts on it. It stands for minor attracted persons. So instead of calling individuals pedophiles, they will now be referred to as MAPS, minor attracted persons.
Immediate now, reaction was a cringe and grimace from me. So yeah, I think we're on the same page.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the problem with this? you know, if we allow there to be an attraction category for minors, I think we are going down a very slippery slope. We need there to be a very bold red line around children, around vulnerable children. All children are vulnerable, around vulnerable adults, mm-hmm. around individuals who have had traumatic brain injuries and who are as a result vulnerable. There is an obligation as a society to do what we can to protect the innocence of children. And I believe that movement to change the language from something that seems harsh and degrading to something that seems like a sexual preference is alarming to me as somebody who's trying to roll out this this concept and this idea that we can recognize this pattern of behavior, because it's a choice. It's a choice to select and target children. It's a choice to groom someone. So parents need to be very aware and conscientious of the fact that most predators are not on a sex offender registry list. Only 30% of all child sexual abuse crimes get reported. So what that means, gentlemen, is that 70% of all cases go unreported. So the sex offender registry list, while a wonderful resource, is as valuable as the paper it's on, because it's not catching the lion's share of potential predators in our communities and in our schools and homes and churches and temples, etc. So this is why we have to be simultaneously rolling out and pushing this movement forward through shows like this, through conversations that are inspired by the book, wherever you are, because there is a growing movement of lessening and lightening our perception of those individuals who are targeting our children.
Yeah, in my opinion, it's the word that came to my mind is it's trying to normalize that, which is not okay. And I just, a follow-up question to that, is that language used in the most current version of DSM? That's hopefully not.
So I haven't seen it updated in the DSM. I will check on that after this conversation, though. You know, it only gets periodically refreshed, right, and reprinted. So I will double check that with the latest edition. But it's a trend as a culture. It's exactly what the two of you are saying. It is shifting our perception from something that is criminal to something that is a preference. And that is alarming to me as somebody who's trying to encourage and promote proactive preventative behaviors, not just for parents, but for people who are in youth serving environments. Just like the two of you have roles and responsibilities with other people's kids, we need everybody to have this awareness and knowledge. What does grooming look like? How can I detect it? And then what do I need to do to interrupt it? That's usually the thing that snags our heels, is the hesitation to speak up, to report something, to call it in, because we fear consequences as adults.
I fear, what if I'm wrong? What if this is completely innocent and I ruin somebody by this? So what step should I take? How should we intervene if we recognize we're moving into that third step and it's getting concerning for us?
Yeah, I think one of the things that parents can often do is bringing it out into the open. You know, when we think about things like hot cases that have come up, we notice, looking back in hindsight, that it was a bit of an open secret, but people were talking about it, but in the muffled rumor mill, if you will. But it takes courage to say in front of the stands, hey, you know, I noticed that you are entering the boys' changing room. You know, we have a policy at this clubhouse that the coaches stay out of the locker room. Guess what? In just having that conversation out loud in front of moms and grandparents and nannies and babysitters and the coach or the identified staff member, you have called the meeting to order. You have said, we're not just going to sit back and sort of whisper and gossip about the situation. We're going to bring it out in adult communication. I was thinking about this the other day because I was listening to my two young daughters playing with each other. And I noticed that they would say, okay, pretend I'm the mom and you're the little sister or you're the daughter. And then they would shift again. Oh, pretend that I'm the mailman and this children actually communicate very clearly. Mm-hmm. It's the adults. It's us. We're the ones who don't clearly communicate our intentions. So imagine if something were happening in a sports arena or in a school system, and somebody used their voice to bring it to the attention of a superintendent, bring it to the attention of a principal, bring it to the attention of the other teachers in the environment. That could revolutionize the grooming process for that targeted child. And let's remember, the majority of the time, 70% of the time, predators have up to 9 victims. So we are not talking about an isolated case or an isolated incident. We are talking about serial behavior. So I think most adults don't realize that they can call DFACS or Department of Family and Children's Services. Some states call it Child Protective Services, and make a report anonymously. What does that mean? That means that you give all the information that you have. It does not come back to you. The reason that sometimes people get into trouble is that they then call up their sister, call up their mother, call up this other person and say, oh yeah, I just called that into DFACS, or I just called that into CPS. Keep it to yourself and make the report. Your job is not to investigate. It's not to litigate. It's not to be the judge, but it is to give that information, because if these crimes go on unreported, we go on unprotected.
I love the statement you made. Basically, you know, if you have a feeling or you see something that's not okay, call it out and talk to that individual about it. I think it's almost human nature for us to not to want to have those difficult conversations. The older I get, I have found there's so much more peace in having that conversation than there is to not have it and to stew on it. So, you know, you definitely make reports. Definitely do that. But if you see someone engaging in a behavior that you do not feel comfortable about, it's going to be better for everyone in the long run to have that awkward conversation.
And John, I would just piggyback on that and say, we have to have that conversation out in public. We do not have that conversation over an email or over a phone call. We have to have that conversation in a hallway, in front of the stands. That's the important piece. As a parent, I am working with the information I have. If I don't have the information, I can't be as prepared as I could be. Yep. So you're absolutely right that calling it in, calling it out, bringing attention to it. Because what I noticed, and what predators would tell me whenever the gossip mill got to be a little too high, they would leave. And do you know where they would go?
Next victim.
They find another school. They find another church. They find another rec league. You know, these are individuals who are going out of their way to put themselves, and this goes back to that GAS model, grooming, access, and space. They go out of their way to put themselves in environments where they have access to children, to vulnerable children. And that's something that we all need to be aware of. And it's even more important then that we have training embedded into schools and into activities and religious communities about what grooming looks like, because you're not going to see child sexual abuse occur in a church, most likely. You're going to see somebody who is working their way to isolate a child and remove the fences around that child. So that's the piece that we need to highlight, just like the legislature out of Kentucky is saying, we can criminalize grooming. You're darn right. And we should criminalize it in our churches, in our rec leagues, in our schools, and in our communities, so that we can interrupt the grooming process and prevent a child from experiencing child sexual abuse.
I think you have done a really good job of shining a light in a very dark area. So just first off, thank you for everything that you do professionally, for the book, and for just the awareness that you bring to everyone, but especially parents. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I do want to ask, you've written this book, anything on the horizon? Do you have anything fun in the works or a next project that you're looking at?
Yeah. So last year I published a workbook for adult survivors or older teens who have been groomed and sexually abused, for parents to do or for adults to do in the privacy of their own home or alongside a clinician. And even better, maybe even forming a counseling group of individual survivors so that individuals can recognize that the pattern is the pattern and it wasn't as personalized as the abuse felt. The project on the horizon that's in the works coming out in about 2 months is a parent-child book for spotting strange behavior together called Wait, That's Weird. Because what I've recognized when working with individuals and visiting people around the country is they say, well, how do I have this conversation with my child? I don't want to conjure fear. I don't want them to panic. But how do I have the conversation? So I teamed up with my daughter, who is an illustrator and an artist, and she illustrated and I wrote the book. And hopefully that will help start a conversation in homes across the country for parents to have some language. And one of the things that I think was really curious in my writing development process for Wait, That's Weird, is I contacted forensic child sexual abuse centers across the country. And I asked them, what do kids say? What are you noticing? What are your observations? And clinician after clinician after clinician told me the one word that kids use when a situation has gone down. Do you know what it is?
Weird.
Weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. So the term that we're now using in schools, I'd be curious to hear what's being used in the environments where you all serve youth, is tricky people. Now, I don't know about you guys, but tricky people, I'm confused already hearing right. that word. That is not easy to understand or easy to define. So in the book, we talk about strange behavior because it's not about stranger danger, but it is about strange behavior. And we can recognize strange behavior because it stands out very differently than what appropriate behavior looks like. So that is the most exciting thing that I've been working on over the course of the last 9 months. And I'm excited to see it come onto the market in the next few months.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I would love to have you back on to talk about when that comes out. But for now, we have Duck Duck Groom, and there's a workbook to go with it. Where can they find this, and where can our listeners find you to follow updates?
Yeah, so all the books are available on Amazon, and my website is annasinoda.com. And I just implore anybody who's listening, if this resonates with you, grab a copy of the book or listen to this, send this on to somebody else. Because the way this is going to make impactful change is in a grassroots way. I cannot do this. I'm in my little pocket here in Atlanta, but somebody somewhere is going to hear this and it's going to resonate. And they get the opportunity to send it on to somebody else who may need to hear this message. And everybody can do their part to prevent predation from taking away the innocence of our children, no matter where you are. And we must prepare parents instead of allowing them to feel paranoid and in paralysis.
Thank you again so much for everything you do. And we really appreciate you taking the time to come on to our podcast today. And I hope that your book is a huge success, because that means more and more people are made aware of these very observable signs. So thank you again.
Thank you both, John and Jamie. I really appreciate the time. And thanks to your listeners for helping spread this message and creating momentum around this movement. Thank you.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.